This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Cost Solutions for Veterans will take place from 8:45 to 5:30 at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. It features workshops, panel discussions, and the newest technology. Lunch will be provided. Don't miss Hearing Loss Solutions for Veterans at 8:45 a.m. Saturday, June 29th at the Oregon Convention Center. Pre-register today at hamiltoncaptel.com/veterans.
Singled out by NSA surveillance, targeted by an FBI sting, in 2007, Yassim Arif was convicted of one charge of money laundering for witnessing a loan. Now, documents released through the Freedom of Information Act reveal the FBI got it wrong from the start. It was a case of mistaken identity, and the feds knew it before the case went to trial. Join me, Linda Olson Osterlund, and my guest, attorney Stephen Downs, on a deeper look this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. It's a case of mistaken identity, right here on KBOO.
Oh, This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at our carbon-neutral Eco Brew Pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia, information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. I have a notion that healing our world can be helped along by empathy and a sense of connection, and that includes even our connection to plants. My guest today, Daniel Shamovitz, has written a book that shows we have more in common with plants than we ever thought. This book is titled What a Plant Knows, A Field Guide to the Senses, and Daniel himself is a director of the Mana Center for Plant Biosciences at Tel Aviv University in Israel, and I think we have him on the phone, right?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. So, Daniel, I just want to, first of all, welcome you to KBOO, and you're speaking to us as I like far across the ocean.
As far as I can get, I guess.
I think so.
Yeah.
And I'd like to just start just really quickly with what got you to be a botanist in the first place. I read that you took it up because you came from a family of doctors and didn't want to do that.
Well, that's probably what, you know, the underlying reason. But the reason I got interested in plant biology is because I took a gap year after high school before going to college. And at that point, I was definitely going to be a pre-med. And then this gap year, I was working on a communal farm in Israel, driving a tractor through the alfalfa fields. And I noticed that when you cut down alfalfa, it grows back, sort of like grass, because actually it is a type of grass. But when you cut down the wheat, it doesn't grow back. Now, not knowing anything about plants or understanding why this, I thought, wow, you know, if we could get the wheat to act like the alfalfa, we could really solve the problem of world hunger.
Ah.
And that's when I started studying plants instead of becoming a pre-med.
So you had a kind of ulterior motive of total goodness for humanity, basically.
Oh, definitely. Like. It was definitely this idea that, you know, I'm not going to, you know, downplay the importance of healing people. But
right.
To feed the world, I mean, that's it.
Right. You want to save everybody.
Sort of, yeah, when you're 18, you sort of see things as black and white.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. But you did study the plant biology, and you ended up learning that humans and plants share a lot, it seems like. I was just so intrigued with the idea that plants themselves, I mean, I sort of suspected it. I mean, I'm one of these people that read The Secret Life of Plants back in the 70s, and that, I know you didn't really like
you're
that
not
in
alone.
Your book. But anyway, that they have a very rich and sensuous life. And what was actually most surprising to you when you started learning this?
Well, that, you know, we tend to think of plants as inanimate.
Uh-huh.
Because we don't see them moving.
Right.
But if you look at the biology that's going on in the cells and in the plants themselves, it's as complex, actually more complex in a lot of ways, than what's going on in animals. From a genetic point of view, plants have more genes than most animals do.
More genes,
and they're complex because they're unmoving, they're rooted. Think about it. When you or any other human or animal has a problem, you can respond by running away.
Right.
Or if you're cold, you can go down south. You know, if you're hungry, you could go to the market or go out to your garden. If you're scared, you could definitely run away. A plant is literally rooted to the ground. It can't escape. It can't choose where it's going to be. So it has to adapt biologically to an ever-changing environment to survive. And that takes an incredible complexity. It has to be able to know where its food is, where the sun is. It has to see it, so that it can grow towards it. It can't just walk away. It has to know if its neighbors are sick, and it does this by smell. And it has to know if the wind is blowing, and it does this by feeling the wind.
And basically, they just have to work it all out just by being stuck totally where they are. And so I'd like to start maybe with, like, let's just start with seeing. What do we should have in common with a plant in terms of being able to see?
What we have in common is that both humans and plants sense electromagnetic energy, light, by proteins in our cells, and then we respond to it. Now, we see in pictures, because we need pictures in order to understand our environment. We see the light from a baseball coming, for example, towards us, and then our brain translates this, and we respond by putting our hand out, hopefully catching the ball. A plant sees the light coming at it. Actually, it can determine which colors are coming. Let's say it's looking for blue light, because that's what it's looking for often. And when it sees blue light coming from the side, like from in a windowsill, it'll then take that signal, transfer it down in its stem, and bend towards the light.
So
at the basic level of absorbing the light energy by a protein, it's called a photoreceptor, translating that signal into some type of developmental change, and then responding, it's very similar.
Uh-huh. And they actually see the color blue. I mean, maybe not in the same way that we do, but they recognize blue.
No, actually, in the same. I mean, they see not in the same way as they're not in seeing a picture.
Yeah.
But if you would put, I mean, it's a great experiment that actually Darwin was one of the first people to do it. If you would put a plant in the dark and put red light on one side and blue light on the other, the plant will bend to the blue light and not towards the red light.
Wow. But they don't see yellow or green, even though they make so much green?
Well, this is just because of the physics of the colors. When we see green, it's because it's being bounced off.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's the one color that's not coming off, that's not being absorbed. Plants absorb red light, and so we don't see any of the red coming through, and they absorb blue light, and the green is bounced off.
So plants
see things that we're absolutely blind to.
Uh-huh.
So from a certain point of view, we're visually challenged from a plant's point of view. Plants can see...
sort of like the way bees do that, too, I think. They see ultraviolet colors.
And they can see far red light, like the light that we barely see as the sun's going down.
Right,
and each
right.
color of light tells the plant something else.
And the other thing that they can do is, like you said, they have a sense of touch, and they can see like up or down. I mean, they can sense up or down, and they can sense actually if you touched their leaf or something like that.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of things going on here. Well, the most obvious one, of course, is the Venus flytrap.
We've all seen
movies of the Venus flytrap, and if you look at these movies carefully, you know, it's a real son of a something there because, you know, it waits until the fly is right in the middle, and only then does it close.
So it just somehow knows that. And you were saying it's got to do with little hairs on the inside of it, inside the...
Well, it's surprisingly similar to how we sense tactile things, how we sense touch also. When the fly is touching these hairs, it's causing an electric signal to go through the leaves of the Venus flytrap. And just like an electric signal on our arm would let us know that a mosquito is on us, and it will send a signal to the brain.
Uh-huh.
Here, the electrical signal goes through the leaves down to the bottom, and it causes it to close very rapidly, albeit without muscles and nerves, but with the same basic mechanism.
Right. And it probably somehow knows that that's all happening. I mean, that's what's interesting to me, too. By the way, I just want to let people know you're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone, and I have Daniel Kemovitz on the phone from Tel Aviv, Israel. He's the author of What a Plant Knows, A Field Guide to the Senses, which is a very fascinating book. We talk a lot about... human beings, you know, like if they go into a coma, they have what you call a vegetative consciousness. And at that point, you want to pull the plug on them. But is a vegetative consciousness really what, I mean, like a plant is, as you say, it's aware. It's not just like in a vegetative coma state then, basically, right?
Well, yeah, that we're really touching on the philosophical, which is actually one of the reasons I wrote the book, but I'm very wary to tread here. When I say what a plant knows, I'm doing air quotes here.
Air quotes, okay.
I'm not claiming that plants have consciousness in that they say, oh, where is the blue light today? Oh, there it is. I think I'll bend to it. You know, it's sort of, there was a fabulous theory of studies that were done with how a dog catches a frisbee. And they came to the conclusion that the dogs are actually doing math in their mind to know what is the exact angle to take. Now, the dog isn't sitting there saying, you know, doing calculus.
Right.
It just does it inherently.
Uh-huh.
Same way a baseball player is not doing calculus, but uses the same route to get to a ball.
Right.
So So a plant is aware, though not conscious.
Okay, so it's doing this stuff sort of just because, so it's not like it's feeling good then or happy or anything
exactly.
like that?
Exactly. There's nothing subjective about a plant.
Uh-huh.
Subjectivity, in my mind, necessitates a brain. And even most neurologists would say that subjectivity necessitates a frontal cortex. Plants, obviously, are brainless. So there's nothing that you can get subjectivity. You know, it's for pain, for example. Pain for a human is something very subjective. What hurts one person doesn't bother another person at all. You know, how do we define what pain is?
Right.
It also comes with an emotional state. Plants are devoid of emotion.
No emotion at all.
We can project our own emotions onto them, but they could care less.
So, and also I noticed that, like, as you sort of debunked the secret life of plants, you said they don't hear anything at all. Like there's this idea for a while that if you played music to plants that they, you know, would grow more fully and enjoy that. But
well, they do.
They do.
The reason they do it probably is because the gardeners are in a much better mood around their plants when music that they enjoy is being played. I can show you studies that show that plants prefer Mozart. And I can show you a study that shows that plants prefer Meatloaf's A Bat Out of Hell. And somehow or another, the plants always preferred the music that the experimenter also preferred.
Ah. And
Now that doesn't mean that plants don't have a sense of hearing. It just means that there's been no really solid evidence to support that. I mean, hundreds of papers talking about plants' responses to light or to touch. There's been very, if not no, solid evidence that plants respond to sound waves. Just in the past year, there have been maybe one or two papers that are starting to really apply solid scientific standards. But these still have to be repeated by other laboratories.
Right.
But music definitely has no place in plant evolution.
But I remember reading somewhere in the book that maybe deeper vibrations, or maybe what you just said about, like, how bees or plants can see colors that we can't even see. They might be aware of some kind of vibrational thing that we're not aware of.
Right.
Who knows?
And that's if I had to put money on what we're going to find a response, it would be in some very high frequency vibration or some very low frequency vibration.
Uh-huh.
You know, people, you know, these have been like grade school science projects with music because these are things we can identify with. But ecologically, they're completely irrelevant. You know, plants have evolved over billions of years. How long have we had classical music?
Right,
you know, this
right.
has not really been a selective tool in plant evolution.
And being able to hear, like, even things crashing through the woods maybe doesn't particularly, I mean, what would they need to hear that for? They can't move anyway,
yeah,
I guess.
Exactly.
Right.
The only thing I can imagine, and again, we're speculating, is that, for example, if a plant could hear the wings of a bee, maybe that would make it make more nectar.
Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
We know that the water vessels of trees during drought give off ultrasonic vibrations.
I was reading that.
Falls down through these pipes. It could be that these vibrations also signal the plant to further protect itself against drought, but we just don't have that evidence yet.
And it's possible. You also talked about. I mean, that could be a communication thing between trees, and. And you talked in the book about how they communicate a lot through the sense of smell. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. So this is actually a great story, both from the science and from the sociology behind it. Because when it was first published in around 1980, that when plants, trees, I think they were elm trees or willow trees, I don't remember exactly, when they're attacked by caterpillars, the leaves give off a chemical signal, a smell, into the air. The trees on the neighboring leaves absorb this chemical signal. In other words, they smell it. And then they start making a chemical that makes the leaf unpalatable to the caterpillars. Now, when this was first published, a large part of the scientific world rejected these results as being completely overinterpreted. A lot of it was backlash against the secret life of plants.
Yeah.
Because also the popular press really picked this up, saying, you know, that a tree is crying out to its neighbor. A tree's bark is better than its bite, all types of things like that.
Right.
But the great part about science is that it's self-correcting, and the person who published those first results, he was actually a graduate student at the time at Cornell, is now the direct scientific director of the Max Planck Institute in Germany, one of the largest science institutes in the world. And what he discovered then as a grad student has now been repeated by tens, if not hundreds, of labs worldwide. And we now know that this is a new paradigm in plant biology.
And how does that actually work? I mean, like the whole sense of smell thing. I mean, like, it's not like a dog sniffing things exactly, is it? Or
well, there's no organ as if we know it. You know, plants don't see through eyes.
Right.
And they don't smell through noses.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that they're not absorbing a chemical signal in the air and then translating that signal into a response. And, you know, what else is smell? You know, like on the 4th of July, which is, I guess, is coming up, and there'll be barbecues all over the place. You'll smell whatever barbecuing in your neighbor's backyard, and that'll cause you to salivate.
Uh-huh.
Unconsciously. It's not that you've decided.
Right, I don't decide to salivate. It just happens.
It just happens. And it's the same thing here. The leaf, the one plant is giving off a chemical into the air. The other plant absorbs this chemical from the air, it's what I'm calling smelling, and then it's responding.
And then the way they respond is they actually, like, they're also like, and I guess that's why they need billions of genes. They have little chemical factories going on, like crazy.
Exactly. You know, we see plants smelling, fruits smelling each other all the time in our houses. I imagine that you've come across and bought a peach or an avocado that wasn't particularly ripe, and you wanted it to ripen quickly. And probably what you did is then you put that avocado into a paper bag together with an overly ripe banana, and then that avocado softens very quickly.
And
or the peach will ripen very quickly.
Yeah.
And the reason that happens is because ripening fruit give off a different gas into the air, a gas that's called ethylene, and this gas induces ripening in neighboring fruits. It's smelled by the fruits. It's a pheromone.
And they're sensitive to that, and then they react to it, just like,
exactly,
as you said, the saliva that happens when I smell meat cooking or
now,
something.
Now, the question in all of this,
yeah,
I guess this is relevant for our discussion about, you know, our place in the world and plants' place in the world. Are these really trees talking to each other?
Right.
What's the intent? You know, on one hand, it's really lovely to think that one tree is in distress and that it's calling out to its neighbor, watch out, you know, I'm getting eaten, but you can help yourself still. And we can identify with that.
Yeah, it seems like trees are helping, yeah.
But there's another option. The other option is, don't forget that trees are almost communities into themselves. So one branch of one tree could be trying to save another branch on the same tree. So it's one leaf on one branch would be communicating with another leaf on the same branch. It's trying to save its, you know, brother, sister branches. And that the neighboring tree is just simply eavesdropping.
Uh-huh. But we don't
have tree psychologists, so we can't really know.
Yeah, we can't know, but in a way, maybe in terms of the big picture, it's as if nature has sort of designed this to work, you know, kind of beautifully. You know, the tree is trying to help itself, and it manages to help the neighboring trees as well.
There's no doubt that there's plenty of evolutionary models where altruism is an advantage. I have a friend, a colleague at Tel Aviv University. She's a theoretical biologist, she worked with numbers, and she can model evolution of altruism or how it could actually be advantageous for one tree to help another, just like it's advantageous for a person to help its neighbor. Or if you, I guess you don't have so many droughts in Oregon.
Occasionally we do.
Occasionally. So, you know, if you have to conserve water, it's good if everyone conserves water. It's for the general good.
Exactly.
So if the neighboring tree becomes resistant to the caterpillars, for example, then there's a chance that there'll be less caterpillars around, and then that tree is also helping itself.
And that it all works for everything.
Exactly.
And two more quick questions, and I guess we're going to be running out of time already.
Oh, wow.
One of them was, the other thing about plants is that besides growing toward light, they also grow toward gravity. And there was some really interesting stuff like that was sort of similar to how our ears actually work in terms of little pieces of stone that kind of roll down.
What I find amazing is the convergence, what we call biologists call convergence of the evolution. In our ears, one of the ways we keep our balance that in the inner ears we have these crystalline structures which always fall to the bottom of the ear. That's how we know where is up and where is down, and when we go on a merry-go-round we get dizzy. In the roots, in the tips of the roots of all plants, they don't have crystalline stones, but they have starch grains. And these starch grains are in the cells, fall to the bottom of the cells. And this is one of the signals that lets it know where gravity is. And so then when you turn a plant on its side, the root always knows where down is because the starch then falls to the bottom. Now, these crystals in animals, in humans, and the starch grains in plants are completely different evolutionarily, but the effect is the same.
Right, and they end up, so nature is across the board using a lot of different things that are the same, but to do different, have different results, and...
It really, you see what seems to be very different on the surface is actually quite similar once you get down to the basic mechanism.
Yeah, that was very interesting. And so just to sort of finish here, how do you think that humans then should be regarding the plants in our world? How should we begin to sort of have a, you know, as we, as I mean, even as I'm pulling weeds after reading your book, you know, I'm sort of, oh gosh, you know, but I mean...
Pull your weeds and don't, as one person said, oh my God, my daughter's never going to eat anything again.
Yeah, like does it feel when I chew the lettuce, you know?
No, there's, first of all, most plants want to be eaten, or these fruits and vegetables, because that's how their seeds get dispersed. There's no pain. There's no pain. For example, even in humans, there's a difference between a touch receptor and a pain receptor in our cells. There have been no pain receptors identified in plants, while there are touch receptors. There's no such thing as pain here. So go ahead, cut your grass, eat your broccoli, pull your weeds. You're not doing any mortal, awful danger to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have to have a larger respect, really, for the plant world and a larger understanding of it, if only for our own good. Everything we do in life is completely dependent upon plants.
Right.
From the oxygen you're breathing, to the cotton clothes you're wearing,
right,
to the wooden furniture in our house, to the dead plants we burn in our cars, and to the food we eat.
Right.
The plant world can live without us plenty, but we can't survive a second without them.
Absolutely.
And if we don't really understand this complexity so that we can better help them survive, we might not ourselves survive on this planet.
Exactly. I really want to thank you, Daniel. It's time to go here.
It's been my pleasure.
But Daniel Chamovitz, author of What a Plant Knows, A Field Guide to the Senses. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this has been The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 11:30.
Tune into Between the Covers every Thursday at 11 a.m. to hear interviews with locally and nationally known authors from both fiction and nonfiction. Between the Covers, only on KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is KBOO Portland. It's the Radio Zine now. I'm still Stephanie Potter again. And our next topic concerns the efforts to enhance wildlife habitat and safeguard continental-scale wildlife corridors. My guest, who is speaking to us from Arizona, is Kim Vaccariu. He's the Western Director for the Wildlands Network, and their mission is to ensure a healthy future for nature and people in North America by scientifically and strategically supporting networks of people, protecting networks of connected wildlands. So, Kim, we have you on the phone right now, right?
Yes, you do. Thank
there you
Stephanie.
Are. And just get as close to that phone as you can get, and we'll sail away here.
Right.
Kim also coordinates the Western Wildway Network Initiative,